This is Audible.
Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents Running is My Therapy. Relieve stress and anxiety, fight depression, ditch bad habits, and live happier by Scott Douglas. Narrated by Stephen R. Thorne. Foreword by Allison Mariella Desir. In 2012, I rarely left my apartment, in part because I had no reason to, I was unemployed, and in part because I was generally unable to muster the courage to get out of bed. If you know me well today, you might be surprised to learn that back then I spent most days on my bed, watching TV and surfing the internet aimlessly. When I was able to get my hands on Xanax, I would take 4 to 6 pills to fall into a deep sleep, from which I secretly wished I would never wake. And when I was able to find only NyQuil, I took dozens of doses a day to calm my restless and ruminating mind. I was depressed. My father was 7 years into a Lewy body dementia diagnosis, which meant that he was a shell of the man I once knew. He was unable to walk, feed himself, or speak in coherent sentences. And because I was unemployed, I shared responsibility for taking care of him when my mother was at work. I was also fresh out of a painful relationship that I'd stayed in for far too long. After many years of hurt and disappointment, I ended things with my partner, which only led me into a deeper, all-consuming depression. It's hard for me to reflect on this time without tearing up. I'd become so socially isolated that I rarely saw friends or family. Even my roommate hardly knew I was there. I was certain that I was the unhappiest person on earth. There couldn't possibly be anyone as miserable as I was. Amid all this self-loathing, though, a bright spot emerged. A friend had signed up for a marathon, and I'd been watching his journey unfold on Facebook, and what struck me was that he was not your typical runner. He was black and not stick-thin. Yet that wasn't stopping him, and his training seemed to be transforming his life. Because he was so unlike what I felt a marathon runner looked like, and much closer to a mortal like me, at the time I couldn't run a mile without stopping, I began to think that maybe I could and should run a marathon too. I had nothing to lose, so I signed up and, in exchange for fundraising for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, received my first training plan. Over the next 16 weeks, I found myself putting up mileage I never thought possible. And as I grew into a runner, I found that running was helping me more profoundly than I could ever have imagined. Running was not only offering me a means of catharsis, it was also opening me up to new experiences and new ways of thinking. For example, running became one of my most effective tools to help me cope with my father's worsening dementia. Knowing that he was slipping away more and more every day was a frightening fact I felt powerless against. Running restored some sense of control. If I couldn't halt his dementia, I could at least be in full charge of my running regimen, my mileage, speed, distance, and route. And when I stuck to my training plan, I found evidence of real results. I could run faster, farther, and with greater ease. It was also the first time there seemed to be a direct connection between effort and improvement. I was hooked, and as I grew more committed to the sport, I joined tune-up races before the marathon and started to set increasingly more challenging fitness goals for myself and crush them. After completing my first marathon and raising more than $5,000 for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society, I knew that running could save me from my depression. I found meaning, purpose, and pride in being able to help others while also helping myself. Today, running is my time to reflect on the challenges I face and the ways I might positively work through them. And it's my daily reminder that I have the power to change the circumstances of my life for the better. If and when I'm particularly anxious, the inherent repetition of running allows me to focus inward and find peace. It's meditation on the move. I almost always finish a run feeling better mentally, often with a renewed sense that I can tackle my life's problems. And perhaps most important, I don't feel alone in my struggles anymore. When I founded the running movement's Harlem Run, an NYC-based social action running movement, and Run for All Women, an organization devoted to empowering women through fitness, also based in New York, I discovered a community of like-minded runners who find the same fulfillment through running that I do. Leading these groups, I've gotten to know hundreds of fellow runners in person and thousands more supporters from around the world on social media. Again and again, they tell me that running has inspired them to take action to change their lives. That keeps me going. In my darkest moments, I wished that there were some easy cure for me to feel better. I wanted someone to prescribe the perfect dosage or the magic number of therapy hours I would need to finally be happy. I would spend hours fantasizing about going on a journey of self-discovery at an expensive rehab facility, the way that I imagined celebrities did, and coming out the other side a new person. Of course, no such easy fix exists. Instead, I stumbled upon running, which gave me the means to manage my depression. All I had to do was put in the work. And the work continues with a dynamic and multi-pronged approach. I seek counseling regularly, I take medication when it's prescribed, and I always get my miles in. And now I have this book, one I only wish I'd had sooner. Running is My Therapy presents the scientific evidence and anecdotes that confirm what I've discovered from my own experience. Running has a profoundly positive impact on your brain, and it can play a critical role in managing depression and anxiety. For some, it might even be all the treatment that's needed. May this book help you uncover your own road to better mental health through running. Introduction. Most Tuesdays, I run early in the morning with a woman named Meredith. For such close friends, we're quite different. Meredith is a voluble social worker who draws energy from crowds. I'm an introverted writer and editor who works from home. Meredith runs her best in large races and loves training with big groups. I've set personal records, PRs, in solo time trials, and tend to bail when a run's head count gets above 5. Meredith is a worrier, beset by regrets and worries, who has sought treatment for anxiety. I have dysthymia, chronic low-grade depression. We like to joke that Meredith stays up late to avoid the next day, whereas I go to bed early to speed the arrival of a better tomorrow. We do have one key thing in common. Meredith and I run primarily for our mental health. Since our teens, we've leaned on regular running to improve the underlying fabric of our lives, our friendships, our marriages, our careers, our odds of being something other than miserable most of the time. Sure, we race. We enjoy the basic motion of running, and we appreciate being fit, lean, and in good physical health. But the main draw of our 75-minute pre-work loop is that we finish it feeling as if we've hit reset and can better handle the rest of the day. Finishing a run in a better mood is a near universal experience. It's so common, in fact, that you can buy t-shirts and mugs that read, "Running is My Therapy." Many people list psychological benefits among their top reasons to run. For those of us with depression or anxiety, however, our relationship to the mental side of the sport is often deeper. We view running's brain benefits the same way that cardiac patients might especially value running's effect on heart health. The daily boosts are wonderful and welcome, but not the whole picture. Experts are still working out the explanation to what Meredith and I and millions of others have discovered. Without regular running, our psychological set point will plummet. I was diagnosed with dysthymia in 1995. Soon after I turned 30. What I described to the psychiatrist that day, however, had been a regular presence in my life since my teens. Starting in middle school, The unease I'd felt as a child gelled into what began to feel like basic aspects of my personality. Low-grade disappointment about how little pleasure life delivers in comparison to the work it requires. Pining for, but seldom finding meaning in events and relationships. Having to rally myself to find the mental and physical energy just to tend to daily affairs. One of the great blessings of my life is discovering running soon after these symptoms took up residence. In the spring of 1979, as a ninth grader, I started running to prepare for high school cross country the following fall. I was immediately hooked. Running was the first thing that combined day-to-day pleasure with the feeling of working towards something meaningful. It took me a while to be able to appreciate and articulate just how profoundly running improved my life by improving my mental health. Depression wasn't openly discussed when I was in school. What little that was said about it had more to do with incapacitating episodes. As a good student who ran at least 70 miles a week, I saw little of myself in that presentation. For many years, I went about my business, running a lot because it was the highlight of most of my days, and because I sensed it uniquely girded me. During that time, I was able to nudge my way into running journalism. Since the early 1990s, I've written hundreds of articles, primarily for Runner's World and the now-defunct Running Times. I've held editorial positions at both publications, and I've written or co-written several running books. Being immersed in the industry has also meant reading, or at least being aware of pretty much everything else that's written about running. As the years went by, I waited for someone to write a book about running and mental health from the perspective of a lifelong runner. It didn't happen. Mental health issues remain underexplored in running culture. That's odd, given the frankness with which runners talk about bodily functions and similar matters with each other. So I decided to write the book myself. Such a book, I told myself, should articulate for fellow runners what running is my therapy means in our marrow. Such a book, I also told myself, should be interesting and useful for all levels of runners. In my view, if you run, you're a runner. There are no entry standards, no set number of miles per week or pace per mile, no given motivations or goals you have to count as a real runner. Although you'll see me use personal examples of distance and intensity throughout this book, they're just that, personal examples, not prescriptions. While listening to them, you'll probably recast them in your own equivalents. Again, to be a runner, you just have to run. That said, most of the mental health benefits we'll look at in this book happen only with regular running. Averaging at least 2 runs per week is a good, doable threshold to gain enough fitness so that every run isn't a challenge. If you struggle with consistency or are just getting started as a runner, there are many excellent books, including Pete McGill's The Born Again Runner, on the nuts and bolts of beginning running. I've long thought that runners with mental health issues have an advantage over our sedentary counterparts. That's not just for the obvious reason that, through luck or pluck, we've already woven regular exercise into the fabric of our lives. As we'll see, a consistent running program is considered an effective standalone treatment for some types of depression and anxiety. It's also now known that regular running causes changes in the brain similar to those associated with antidepressant medications. And a lot of research has shown that exercise done in conjunction with typical treatments produces better results than the treatments done in isolation. But there's another way in which we runners have an advantage. Regular running encourages and helps inculcate certain ways of thinking and behaving. It turns out that these habits of mind and body are strongly connected to common interventions for depression and anxiety, such as talk therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, strong social connections, and good self-care practices. Our advantage here is twofold. First, we naturally practice some of these techniques as runners, thereby enjoying some of the benefit on our own. Second, Being at least slightly familiar with various forms of treatment makes success with them more likely if we decide to seek professional help. That's why this book is organized as it is. We'll start with detailed overviews of how running helps the brain, how it helps people with depression and anxiety over the long run, and what's behind the day-to-day improvements in mood that are one of running's great calling cards. Then, we'll look at the intersection of running and several forms of treatment for depression and anxiety. To do all of that, we'll meet several people who, like me, have found running to be singularly effective in managing their mental health. We'll also hear from a wide range of experts, most of whom are runners, to explain the what and why behind my and others' experiences. We'll also see summaries of a decent amount of research on the many topics this book covers. I don't want to give the impression that running solves everything. I'm never going to be a skipping down the street kind of guy, except when I amuse the neighbors by doing running form drills. What running has done for me for almost 4 decades, and what I hope it will do the rest of my life, is to help me more often be my best, interested in rather than dismissive of others, engaged in rather than beaten down by work, hopeful rather than fearful toward the future. The time I spend running is powerful medicine not just while I'm running, but for most of the rest of the day too. If this book helps you to understand and appreciate a little better the role of running in your mental health, it will have been worth both of our time. Chapter 1. How Running Helps Your Brain. The name of the running shoe brand ASICS is an acronym for the Latin phrase anima sana in corpore sano. The literal translation is a healthy soul in a healthy body. I don't have the original Greek handy, but Plato was getting at a similar point when he wrote, "The greatest mistake in the treatment of diseases is that there are physicians for the body and physicians for the soul, although the two cannot be separated." It's long been understood that physical and mental health go together. Although our mind, or soul, to the ancients, is more than our brain, you need a well-functioning brain to have a vibrant mind. It's odd, then, when people don't think that their brain needs the same care and consideration accorded to other body parts. Experience and a growing body of research show that regular physical exercise is just as beneficial for your brain as it is for your heart, muscles, bones, and every other part of your body. The bulk of this book is about the integration of body and mind via running for help in managing depression and anxiety. But that essential body-mind link is pertinent to everyone, regardless of the particulars of their mental health. So, before we look in depth at running, depression, and anxiety, let's start with some of the most important evidence for how exercise is necessary for optimal brain health. The smart runner. We runners like to think we're smart because we run, and we are. If smart because we run means we're smart to run, given the mountain of evidence on how running improves health and vitality while reducing the risk for heart disease, diabetes, high blood pressure, stroke, some types of cancer, and other diseases. One large long-term study even found that runners are at lower risk of developing cataracts. But smart because we run can be taken even more literally, in the sense of smarter than we otherwise would be. Research overwhelmingly shows that people who regularly do aerobic exercise, such as running, perform better on several types of cognitive tasks. To flip the equation, research shows that, on average, sedentary people do worse in several common measures of cognitive performance. Jeffrey Burns, MD, is a 6-time marathoner, brain researcher, and professor of neurology at the University of Kansas. He acknowledges that a runners are smarter message might have a chicken or egg quality to it. From a scientific perspective, we know that smart people exercise and that people who exercise tend to be smarter to start with, he says. We have dozens, if not hundreds, of studies showing that exercise is associated with smartness, But we don't necessarily know if that's because smart people exercise or exercise makes us smarter. Burns says it's probably a combination of both. On an individual level, what matters is improvement within your range of inherent intellect. Running an hour a day isn't going to put me anywhere near the intellectual level of wheelchair-bound Stephen Hawking. But all evidence is that my mileage makes for a smarter Scott than if I were sedentary. Consider experiments in which half a group of people start an aerobic exercise program and the other half remain sedentary. After as little as 6 weeks of regular workouts, the exercisers improve their performance on several mental tests, including working memory, the ability to temporarily store and use information needed to carry out a task, and visuospatial processing, the ability to perceive and interact with what you see around you. There's also good evidence that getting fit improves attentional focus, which is the ability to focus on relevant cues in an environment while working toward a goal. I remind myself how attentional focus differs from more general focus by thinking about trail running. Attentional focus is surveying the ground I'll encounter in the next few strides to make sure I don't trip, when instead I focus on finding edible mushrooms or locating owls in trees, I frequently fail to meet the goal of staying upright. What's been most consistently linked to exercise is executive function, Burns says. That's the ability to plan and organize, to take in information and act on it. That's a really important part of day-to-day life, taking in a lot of information and making goal-oriented decisions and planning. The best example of executive function is something like putting together Thanksgiving dinner, where you've got 50 ingredients and 10 things you're making, and the timing of everything is different but needs to end at the same time. Task juggling, a la Burns's Thanksgiving dinner example, has long been my favorite part of working, from waiting tables to editing Runner's World's daily news channel. It's a fun challenge to see how many things with different timelines I can keep moving forward. This is not multitasking. It's been pretty well established that doing several things at once, emailing one person and texting another while participating in a conference call, reduces your performance on each task. Executive function is better understood as focusing on one thing for the time it requires, while not inhibiting the progress of the other tasks you have in motion. It's nice to think that being a runner made me better at most of the jobs I've had. If, instead, you find yourself in a situation requiring sustained focus on one thing, you'll still probably do better if you're a runner. That's a reasonable conclusion to make from the available research, such as a Spanish study that found aerobically fit subjects performed better than sedentary people on a test of sustained mental focus. For the study, researchers gathered 22 triathletes who trained 8 or more hours a week and 20 people whom they classified as having low aerobic fitness. The subjects performed a dull but demanding task for 1 hour. Sitting in front of a black computer screen, they were to react as quickly as possible when they saw a full red circle, which appeared at intermittent intervals. The average test involved reacting to about 400 circles. The researchers measured the subjects' reaction times and brain activity in 12-minute segments during the 1 hour test. In the first 36 minutes, the triathletes had quicker reaction times than the less fit subjects. Throughout the test, the triathletes' brains showed greater brain activity associated with allocating mental resources to a task, as well as brain activity associated with a preparatory response to a task. Taken together, the researchers wrote, the results demonstrated a positive association between aerobic fitness, sustained attention, and response preparation. Sustained attention is the ability to maintain performance over a long period of time, which depends on maintaining vigilance, the ability to detect the stimulus, and resistance to distraction. Antonio Luque Casado, PhD, the lead author of the study, told me in an email. A reduced ability to monitor significant sources of information directly affects all cognitive abilities. For example, slow responses and/or failures to respond to target stimuli. Therefore, sustained attention is an inherent function of general cognitive performance that is critical to cognitive abilities in humans. Luque Casado said that being able to sustain mental attention is important in both everyday activities, such as driving or absorbing a presentation at work, and intricate professional tasks, such as performing surgery or handling air traffic control. The general "exercise makes you smarter" good news appears to be true throughout life. Research has found better cognitive performance among fit people, whether they're school-aged, younger adults, middle-aged, or older adults. These "running makes you smarter" findings generally have to do with mental acuity during our sedentary hours. But what about when we're running? Get running, get creative. Research backs what you've probably noticed. Your brain seems to kick things up a notch once you're in a running groove. A Dutch study published in 2013 found that regular exercisers performed better on a creative problem-solving test when they did a short workout. The research involved 96 people, half of whom were sedentary, and half of whom exercised at least 3 times a week over the previous 2 years. Half of each group did 2 types of mental tasks while at rest, and the other half of each group did the tasks while riding a stationary bike. The tasks measured 2 key components of creativity: divergent thinking and convergent thinking. Divergent thinking is used to generate many new ideas when more than one solution is correct. This is, ideally, what happens during a brainstorming session. In the study, for example, participants were asked to come up with as many uses as possible for a pen: write a note, drum on a table, give as a gift, make a new belt hole because you've lost so much weight, etc. Convergent thinking, in contrast, is used to come up with one good solution to a problem. As an example, the study participants were presented with 3 unrelated words, for example, hair, time, and stretch, and asked to think of an associated word common to the 3, in this case, long. As expected, the regular exercisers did better than the sedentary people in both types of tasks. The most noteworthy result was that the fit people did better on the convergent thinking test while exercising than when at rest. This might not surprise anyone who's had an aha moment 10 minutes into a run after mulling a problem all day, but it's nice to see the phenomenon backed by research. The non-fit people, meanwhile, performed worse when cycling than when at rest. The researchers speculate that the unaccustomed activity taxed their brains enough to impair concentration. The researchers wrote, "From the current results, one may even speculate that for people who are used to exercise, the absence of exercise impairs creative performance more than its presence improves it." Burns is familiar with this phenomenon. He walked while we talked to better collect his thoughts, and he explained that running helps his writing. "When I'm out running," he said, "sentences will pop into my head, and they sort of come together in a new way. The ideas, or new ways of thinking, tend to bubble up and appear without effort when I've been working hard and not getting them in my usual environment." Burns says he doesn't have a sound explanation for why this happens, but in his expert opinion, it's cool. "For my part, much of this book was hashed out in my head while running the trails of Cape Elizabeth, Maine. The steady beat of my footsteps induces a sense of rhythm that lets me hear how sentences in a paragraph should flow. It's much rarer for the words to just fall into place when I'm sitting in my home office, urging thoughts to organize themselves while trying to block out distractions." Burns and I learned long ago something else discovered by the convergent thinking researchers. The creative boost from working out for the regular exercisers was temporary. As the researchers put it, the enhancement of cognitive control processes by aerobic fitness is so short-lived that positive effects are restricted to performance during or directly after exercising. Burns says, "When I get home from a run, I have to write it down right away, or it's gone. It's like waking up from a dream." Here's the one life hack you'll hear in this book. On those happy occasions when the way out of a writing maze or the solution to NPR's Sunday puzzle appears 6 miles into a run, I move my wedding band to my right ring finger. Otherwise, the thought will slither away as suddenly as it appeared. When I get home, seeing the ring on the wrong hand reminds me of my breakthrough. Not all runs are created equal when it comes to getting this immediate boost in smarts. You've probably done an especially long or hard workout, and for the next few hours not been able to think much beyond, "I like food, kittens are cute." Over the course of my highest mileage week of my life, 184 miles, my cognitive threshold went from reading Shakespeare's Richard II to watching cable news. When it comes to highly exhaustive exercise, yes, there's a refractory period. J. Carson Smith, Ph.D., a brain researcher and kinesiology professor at the University of Maryland, says, "You need to recover. There is evidence that you can impair cognitive function with high-intensity exercise. Your attention has a limited capacity. With long runs," Smith says, "you're depleting your glycogen stores, which are your muscle's stored form of carbohydrate. Your brain needs glycogen to function well. You need to rehydrate, replenish glycogen stores. It's not surprising that people who train intensely for long periods of time need some time for a recovery period." As Smith points out, 3-hour runs and long, hard track workouts are more the exception than how most people run most of the time. Your standard getting in the miles run at a moderate pace produces more of the immediate get smart benefits. And those benefits can occur much sooner after the workout ends, Smith says. There appears to be a sweet spot of longer but not too long. In one study, the immediate gains were similar after 20 and 40 minute workouts, but half an hour later, the longer workouts seemed to impart more lasting effects. I don't want to make too big a deal about these immediate benefits. In addition to being transitory, the amount of effect is small to moderate. A conversational pace 5-miler will probably help me finish a Sudoku puzzle faster, but it isn't going to transform me into a chess master. What's really exciting is how these daily hits appear to help us age better. A better brain in the long run. If you want to feel good about being a long-time runner, talk to brain researchers like Burns and Smith. Now in my 50s, I like to think my decades of running have me in much better physical health than my high school and college classmates, who have been sedentary since we were in school. Facebook photos at least superficially support this belief, so hooray for running on that count. But not until I really delved into this topic did I appreciate just how much good my lifetime of running has presumably done on the cognitive side of things. Burns, whose current research focuses on dementia and Alzheimer's disease, says, "Staying active and maintaining heart and lung function goes a long way toward promoting the long-term health of your brain. As we get older, we're all at risk of cognitive decline. In people who continue to exercise, we tend to see a slowing of that inevitable decline in some areas of cognition. The evidence certainly points to good cardiorespiratory fitness during your long-term risk of developing Alzheimer's disease, stroke, and cardiovascular disease. Two main factors are at play here: slowing or stopping the typical age-related loss in brain tissue, and better preserving the underlying structure of key brain areas, such as the frontal lobe, the key player in executive function, and hippocampus, where much work having to do with memory occurs. These benefits, like a Sunday afternoon free of errands or a morning spent watching birds while sipping your coffee, are perhaps better appreciated with age. If you're exercising in midlife, you're doing your brain a favor for the long term, Smith says. That's something that young people tend not to be thinking about. being motivated to run today to help their brain when they're 60 or 70. But we think if you start earlier and maintain longer, your benefits are probably greater. Not that I plan to stop running anytime soon, and neither should you. But it's possible that some of the brain boost from years of running might stick around if you were forced to become sedentary. We assume the cumulative effects of exercise provide some protection over time, Smith says. Entering middle age as someone who has run for several years should build a cognitive reserve that as you continue on in life you can draw upon, he says. One study in this vein followed 2,700 people over a 25-year period. It found that when the subjects were between 43 and 55 years old, those with the greatest cardiovascular fitness a quarter century before did better on tests of verbal memory, recalling a list of words, and psychomotor speed, physically reacting to a cognitive stimulus. At the other end of the spectrum, these brain health benefits support the idea that it's never too late to start running. When older people begin an aerobic exercise program, there's evidence that there are boosts to certain aspects of memory and thinking, as opposed to slowing or decline, Burns says. A review of research on exercise and cognitive function in older people concluded that physical exercise is a promising non-pharmaceutical intervention to prevent age-related cognitive decline and neurodegenerative diseases. In an aging society, Burns's work is part of an important movement, and he's excited to conduct research on exercise and older people's brains. 40 years ago, running and diet and exercise were not a part of how to go after heart disease, he says. Now, that's standard. We're kind of sitting where cardiology was 40 years ago and leveraging what we think is true about lifestyle and its importance to brain health. Those with a more-is-better mindset will appreciate a key finding from Burns's research on both younger and older adults. The greatest gains in cognitive function were by the people who most improved their VO2 max, the gold standard for measuring aerobic fitness. Your VO2 max is the maximum amount of oxygen you can breathe in and deliver to working muscles during exercise. Runners have among the highest VO2 maxes of all athletes. An individual's cardiorespiratory fitness response was a better predictor of cognitive gains than exercise dose, i.e. duration, and thus maximizing an individual's cardiorespiratory fitness may be an important therapeutic target for achieving cognitive benefits, concludes a Burns study on previously sedentary people aged 65 or older. It's not clear if it's the heart and lung function that's driving the brain benefits, or if it's that the people who achieve that increase in fitness level are achieving broad physiological benefits, Burns told me. I think it does suggest that maybe we need to focus on ways to better boost cardiorespiratory fitness, and intensity is one way to do that. That's something our future studies will focus on. Do we need to do high-intensity training versus just moderate intensity focused on duration? As is my wont, I extrapolated from Burns's research to my situation. Is it reasonable, I asked, to think that, for those who are already fit, regularly including hard workouts is better for brain health than nothing but easy to moderate running? Even when you had no racing plans, should you do such workouts as 800-meter repeats at 5K race pace, which improve your VO2 max more than conventional pace runs? You're interpreting it the way we're thinking about it, Burns replied. Bless him. The way I think about it from an exercise physiology standpoint is that the right target is to boost cardiorespiratory fitness. So, when we're designing a prescription for exercise, our goal should be to boost cardiorespiratory fitness for that person. Our data suggest that's necessary to achieve the brain benefits. The oxygenated brain is a happy brain. What's behind these improvements in cognitive functioning that, on the face of it, seem to have nothing to do with running? After all, When you do a very long run and draw down your leg muscle's glycogen supply, your body responds by improving your ability to deposit and hold on to these stores of carbohydrate. That's an example of adapting to a stress by anticipating the stress occurring again and rebuilding to better handle the next time it occurs. The body's typical stress-recover-adapt cycle doesn't seem to apply to something like an improved ability to focus on relevant items, especially when some of those improvements occur while you're running. In the case of running-induced cognitive improvements, the benefit appears to be indirect. One view is that substances that the body produces more of in response to running happen to also lead to enhanced brain function. As one review of research on the topic puts it, the areas of brain most influenced by aerobic fitness are higher order regions involved in the control of cognition and memory. For example, muscles release a protein called cathepsin B after exercise to speed recovery. In 2016, researchers linked increased circulating levels of cathepsin B to greater production of a protein called brain-derived neurotrophic factor, BDNF. As we'll see in greater detail later, BDNF contributes to the growth of more neurons in the brain and increases in the size of the hippocampus. In a study that compared BDNF levels following distance running, resistance training, and high-intensity interval training, the biggest increases came from distance running. This makes sense if the cathepsin B theory is correct, because the impact stress of distance running would likely spur the muscles to release more of the protein for repair. Any one specific mechanism, such as cathepsin B leading to BDNF increases, is only part of the organic whole of you, the runner. The physiological changes of one bout of exercise are profound and have an impact on every aspect of you and your body, Burns says. Two of the more obvious changes during a run are increased blood pressure and increased blood flow to the brain, leading to feeling more alert. Increased brain blood flow could certainly enhance areas of the brain that are processing information, notes Smith. But, Smith is quick to add, the difficulty with understanding how running affects the brain is that it affects several related systems at once. You're getting increases in BDNF, but you're also getting increases in other neurotransmitters, such as norepinephrine, serotonin, and dopamine, he says. So it's probably a combination of these types of neurotransmitters that are helping the reward-related circuitry of your brain to function more effectively. In addition, Smith adds, increased levels of substances such as norepinephrine modulate nerve cells in the brain. They can help dampen the noise and increase the gain on the signal you're trying to attain so that the networks can better resolve the right decision more quickly, or the memory comes to mind more easily, he says. All of those things come together and play a role. It's perhaps even more complicated to tease out what causes the long-term benefits of running to brain health. People argue over which one is most important, Burns says. I think they're all important, and they're all probably playing a role in providing these benefits to the brain. Greater blood flow on a regular basis is one contributor. Healthier blood vessels react appropriately to constrict and relax when needed to deliver blood to different parts of the brain, Smith says. But what about other aspects of structural change? Luque Casado told me that the attention required while running probably isn't the main driver behind his findings of endurance athletes performing better on tests of focus. Other researchers might disagree. Using MRIs to measure the brains of competitive runners and age-matched sedentary people, a University of Arizona study found that the runners had greater functional connectivity between separate parts of their brains. The parts of runners' brains that were wired differently are involved in the higher-level cognitive work we've seen elsewhere in this chapter, such as working memory, attentional focus, and processing speed. In discussing their findings, the researchers suggested that regular running seems to rewire our brains. High-intensity aerobic activity that requires sustained, repetitive locomotor and navigational skills may stress cognitive domains in ways that lead to altered brain connectivity, they wrote. Those of us who have been able to retrace an old running route for the first time in a decade can appreciate the idea that making our way through the world builds our brains in this way. As the Arizona researchers put it, enhanced connectivity may occur in response to cognitive demands during exercise, yet the strengthened connections may improve executive function more broadly, allowing for improved cognitive function later in life. Another key to later in life brain health is running's role in lowering inflammation. Amyloid plaques are fibrous clumps of protein fragments that attach to the outside of cells and are thought to contribute to Alzheimer's and other cognitive problems. Smith and Burns agree that regular running can help to remove these plaques and other toxic substances from the brain. Those potentially obscure-sounding things with names like brain-derived neurotrophic factor and norepinephrine play a huge role over time. Well-functioning neurotransmitter systems lead to nothing really becoming overexpressed or not responding quickly enough, thus keeping the brain's system for responding to stress and other stimuli well-regulated and in balance, Smith says. Improved function in and increased size of the hippocampus means that with age, this key part of the brain can be protected somewhat, which in turn enhances overall brain function. All of the that is much more than was known about the body-mind-health connection when someone first said, anima sana in corpore sano. Regular running has as profound an effect on your brain's health as it does on the body parts most people more often focus on. For those of us who run in part to manage our mental health, these benefits are even more noteworthy. Many of the positive changes here described, increased BDNF levels, better functioning neurotransmitter systems, growth in the hippocampus, are key to running, providing short and long-term relief from depression and anxiety. That's the subject of the next few chapters. Chapter 2. How Running Helps People with Depression. Say you woke one morning with ringing in your ears. The first thing you'd probably do is review recent events for a cause. You went to a concert, flew, ate in a loud restaurant, and so forth. If you couldn't discern a cause, you might wonder what's going on, and perhaps Google sudden ringing in ears. The ringing might dominate your day, and then, in the likely event it soon went away, you'd forget about it. If the ringing persisted for a few weeks, you'd probably get it checked out, even if you knew what had triggered it. If it then went away, you'd keep the incident in the back of your mind and be more concerned if later that year you had another ringing episode. If the ringing never went away, you'd realize you have tinnitus. You'd tell yourself it's going to be something to deal with the rest of your life. You'd develop coping strategies, experiment with ways to manage it, and try to get on with living your life. In your more self-pitying modes, if someone complained they had ringing in their ears after a long plane ride, you might think, try having it all the time, for no obvious reason. That's one way of thinking about depression compared to the short periods of sadness, lethargy, and reduced interest in normal activities that everybody experiences. Living with depression means finding ways to manage it so that it interferes as little as possible. For many of us, being a runner is one of our key coping strategies. We feel intuitively what experts increasingly believe, that running not only helps us feel better, but also has carryover benefits that can improve other aspects of our lives. A quick overview of depression. Although there's less stigma attached to depression and other mental health disorders than there used to be, many people still struggle with discussing these issues openly. That's odd when you consider how prevalent depression is. The World Health Organization says that depression is the leading cause of disability worldwide, including in the United States and Canada. The National Institute of Mental Health estimates that in 2015, 16.1 million adults in the United States had at least one depressive episode. That figure represented 6.7% of the adult population at the time and included only people who met the classic definition for a major depressive episode, a period of at least 2 weeks during which they experienced a depressed mood and at least four other symptoms indicating significant changes in functioning: dramatic drop in energy, different sleeping and eating patterns, difficulty concentrating, lower self-esteem, decreased interest in normally pleasurable activities, etc. The number of people living with depression would be higher if it included those with chronic depression, as well as children and teens. I would say 10 to 15% of the population at any time could be thought of as depressed, says Frank Brooks, Ph.D., a clinical social worker and professor in Portland, Maine. So, in any year, that's more than 30 million people in the U.S. alone. Offering a concise description of depression is difficult. It's not a binary condition, like having a broken bone or being pregnant. Clinicians look at a large number of symptoms having to do with how people think, act, and feel. Gradations of depression, mild, moderate, severe, can be a judgment call. One well-known screen, the Mood and Feeling Questionnaire, MFQ, cautions users that there are no prescribed cut points that unambiguously define the presence or severity of depression. There's also great variance in how people experience depression. I've never been suicidal, and I'm too vain to respond with anything but not true to the MFQ potential symptom, I could never be as good as other people. But to other MFQ symptoms, I felt miserable or unhappy, or I felt lonely, or I didn't enjoy anything at all, my first reaction is often, what thinking person wouldn't feel that way? Further clouding clear categories is that many depression screenings have to do with recent feelings and behaviors, such as over the past 2 weeks. These more accurately capture depressive episodes, a somewhat sudden change in mood, behavior, energy level, and so on. There are also what are known as depressive disorders, in which symptoms are less severe but more persistent. It's tricky because if people have always had symptoms and it's been lifelong, they might not know any difference. Brian Vasey, MD, a clinical psychiatrist and runner from Madison, Wisconsin, says about diagnosing some people. Indeed, when I look at such screening statements as, I felt like talking less than usual, or I was moving and walking more slowly than usual, I often think, no, not more so than usual, but that's not saying much. All that being the case, it can be more helpful to hear others' general descriptions of depression than offer an ironclad definition. Let's start with therapists. I would describe depression as a feeling of joylessness, meaninglessness, lack of motivation, lack of caring, Vasey says. But it depends. People are different. Kids who are depressed can be angry and quite easily irritated. I've had people who say they felt like everyone is mean to them, and when the depression got better, they felt like, wow, people are being nice. They didn't feel like their mood was better, but felt that people were treating them better. Brooks emphasizes functioning in daily life, sleeping, going to work, meeting your normal responsibilities to yourself and others. There's a profound difference between I'm having a bad day at work and I'm having a bad day at work and I'm not going to get out of bed tomorrow because of it, he says. Brooks also hones in on how one's relationships are faring. Even mild depression can have very, very significant effects on interpersonal relationships. Vasey and Brooks agree with Dr. Laura Fredenhall, PsyD, a clinical psychologist and runner from Terre Haute, Indiana, who says, the duration of feelings and number of symptoms are the key to making a diagnosis. But I like to see the person as more than a representation of someone who has a depressive disorder. Vasey agrees. It's all about the person in front of me and their relationships. It's, who are you? rather than what are your symptoms. What about runners with depression? I'll describe my early experiences with running and depression later in this chapter. Here are a few other runners' takes. Kristen Barry, a lifelong runner from Scarborough, Maine, recalls first feeling depressed in middle school. "When it's not that bad, it's just a low-level sadness," she says. "Sometimes it's tiredness and a level of hopelessness, wondering why I can't feel like what seems like everyone else, but not at a crippling level." Barry had one severe episode in 1997 during her first year of law school. "I couldn't concentrate, felt despair and extreme hopelessness, didn't enjoy anything, and withdrew myself from just about everything." Rich Harfst of Annandale, Virginia, is another lifelong runner who has dealt with depression since his teens. A therapist gave him a diagnosis at age 17. "Because I was beginning to interact more with the external world, it started showing up in how I behaved at school and my part-time job," he says. "My parents thought I was going through some adjustment issues or teenage anger issues." Now in his 50s, Harfst has experienced both chronic and episodic depression. "I have some behaviors that are manic-depressive in nature, but my manic is very subdued," he reports. "I correct to a medium, but for me it's a pretty big high. I've had half a dozen periods in my life where, for one reason or another, I've sunk into a longer funk on the order of 6 weeks." Amelia Gappin, a software engineer from Jersey City, New Jersey, has also dealt with chronic and episodic depression, although the latter has improved since she became more dedicated to running. "There was always the underlying steady state of depression throughout the daily stuff that gets in the way," she says. "But then there was the episodic period when it would be really bad for 6 weeks, 2 months, where I couldn't even get myself out of bed. During the weekends, it was wake up and take a couple of hours to move myself to the couch, and then just kind of stay there." People think depression is feeling bad, but a lot of times you just kind of feel nothing. You feel empty and drained of any emotion. Given the great variance in how people experience depression, it's perhaps not surprising that its causes are still unclear. The National Institute of Mental Health offers the sweeping explanation: "Current research suggests that depression is caused by a combination of genetic, biological, environmental, and psychological factors." To take just one example of the complexity of causes, modern antidepressants address biological factors, such as deficits in the brain's serotonin system. But not everybody with such a deficit develops depression, and not everybody with depression displays unusual brain chemistry. There's also no expert consensus on whether biological observations, such as shrinkage in the brain area known as the hippocampus, are a cause or a consequence of depression. One theory is what's known as kindling, in which a depressive episode alters the brain's structure or functioning in such a way that it's more vulnerable to subsequent life event stressors. This interaction of biological and environmental factors might help explain why some people can have a major depressive episode after a stressful event, such as the death of a child, and then never be depressed again once they recover, whereas others can become incapacitated by comparatively minor stressors. Rich Harfst has had depressive episodes triggered by the end of romantic relationships, and Amelia Gappin had a major episode in the wake of gender transition surgery. No compassionate person would deny the reality of Harfst's and Gappin's suffering, but its existence after events that others experience without becoming depressed is a reminder of just how tricky ferreting out depression's causes can be. Even the well-established family history link can be difficult to untangle. A genetic component seems obvious on the face of it, but what about environmental and psychological factors, such as socioeconomic status and children's adopting their parents' ways of thinking and coping? As far as I know, none of my 5 siblings and neither of my parents have been diagnosed with depression. But one of my grandfathers received electroshock therapy for depression, indicating his condition was quite severe, given the shame attached to mental health issues in the first half of the 20th century. Did unfavorable brain chemistry skip two generations and then pass on